Earth and Alien Enterprise, Timothy Good, 2013. Chapter 1. It was a late afternoon in the summer of 1932, a mile and a half east of Kir Deer, North Dakota. Two farm boys, 12-year-old Leo Dershak and his younger brother Mike, had finished their chores for the day and were exploring a grassy hilltop near the farm. It was little Mike who first spotted a strange object in the valley below. It was a huge, round thing, Leo recounts in his remarkable book, UFOs Are With Us, Take My Word. One, we just stood there gaping at it and began excitedly discussing what it was doing down there and trying our best to understand just what we were seeing. It was silvery, and although it was probably more than half a mile away, we could tell it was certainly as big as our barn, maybe even bigger. It appeared to be perfectly round, and I counted many different colors of light on it that came from a band around the edge. I thought it must be a machine because it was rotating in a complicated way. The flashing colored lights formed an outer shell, like a band or belt that went completely around it at the widest point and was turning one way. The inner shell seemed to be standing still or perhaps turning the other way. It was totally silent and produced no cloud of exhaust fumes or smoke. We stood there on the hilltop for some time, just watching that incredible machine. Then we decided to try to get closer for a better look. As we began to walk downhill toward the machine, we were still more amazed to find our way blocked by an invisible force that would not let us get any closer. It was as if we were bumping up against an invisible fence or wall. We encountered that invisible something again and again, sliding to one side and the other against its unyielding surface. Finally, we gave up our efforts to approach it and just sat on the hillside next to the barrier, watching the machine and debating the situation. The boys renewed their efforts to penetrate the invisible barrier by approaching it from different directions. To no avail. Finally, we just sat back down and watched, Leo continued. Before too long, we saw the curious rotation slow and eventually stop, and the colorful lights stopped blinking at the edge of the machine. We also noticed that the outer shell now had an opening, that had somehow opened up in the side of the machine. Out of it came three people who walked down a sort of ramp that, just as miraculously, sprouted out of the side of the machine. They stood in the dry weeds beside their enormous, silvery machine. We watched the distant figures very closely and saw that they were all wearing the same type and color of suit or coverall. These people walked only a short distance from the machine and moved around near it. They finally returned to the machine and closed the door, and the ramp just went away again. The boys were anxious to return to their farmhouse near Kir Deer, a long walk away, in time for dinner. They refrained from telling the rest of the family what had happened. The next day, they hiked directly back to the hillside, but the huge machine was nowhere to be seen, nor did they see it again until 2 weeks later. It was mid-afternoon as we stood in the same valley, looking at the ground, and puzzling about how there was no sign that anyone had even walked here, wrote Leo. I cannot explain why, but our senses somehow told us to look up. There, high in the sky and almost straight above us, we saw the machine. It was flying. It was an airship. We quickly moved back up the hillside and out of the way behind some bushes. The airship we had spotted was now slowly nearing the valley floor. It was clearly coming in for a landing. We could sense a strange stillness that grew about us. This stillness gave us the first hint I can remember of a feeling that these people could stop all movement around them at any given time. I am certain we were the only witnesses to the ship's landing. The appearance of the ship was the same as we remembered from our first sighting, a mirror-like exterior with a central rotating band that emitted colored lights. When the ship came to rest, the rotating band slowed to a stop, and the lights went out as before. Once the craft had landed, on four legs with pads at the end of each, the boys were again prevented by the mysterious invisible force from approaching. We noticed nothing was moving. Not a blade of grass or the branches on the bushes, Leo continued. While we sat by the barrier and watched this huge machine, the strange door started to open again. A total of six men emerged from the door and walked down the ramp. They were dressed in a different kind of uniform than when we first saw them, but we were somehow certain they were the same men as we saw before. We were close enough to see that they now wore a shirt slack type of clothing that looked quite comfortable. We wished we had such fine clothes, instead of our ragged overalls and patched cotton shirts. The men began doing something that looked peculiar. We couldn't figure out what they were up to. All six men would repeatedly reach down to the ground and apparently pick up something from the earth. Whether or not they took it with them, we could not tell. I don't know why, but I was convinced they could see us. The boys stayed for an hour or so but, as before, needed to return home for supper. Mike and I were not happy about leaving, but the length of the shadows and the position of the sun told us our time that day was up. Leo and Mike decided to tell their parents. Mom and Dad listened patiently to our excited story, explained Leo. They agreed with us that something like this machine, this airship, could exist, but advised us just to forget about everything we had told them. We were very, very disappointed at their response to what was for us the most exciting experience of our lives. The next day, Leo and Mike went into Kidia, anxious to discuss the matter with their friend Mr. Brooks, described for me by Leo's friend Barry Potter as an educated, well-traveled man, Kidia's cosmopolitan intellectual, who operated the grain elevator and who they thought might be able to explain what they'd seen. One of our theories about the machine, said Leo, was that it was a new government plan for killing the hordes of grasshoppers that were eating our crops. We thought these people might be part of a government project to spray the countryside with DDT, a new chemical that was supposed to kill troublesome insects like grasshoppers and mosquitoes. DDT, per se, was not introduced until 1939. However, as Barry explained to me, Leo had described spray units driving through Kidira around this time, fogging the neighborhoods with what he referred to as DDT. Boys, I don't think you are crazy, said Mr. Brooks. I saw one of those things flying through the air without a sound. It was definitely some kind of airship. What I saw fits right in with what you have seen. He was mystified, however, that the machine made no sound, such as produced by Zeppelins, for example. In those days, people did not even mention things like what we had seen, Leo explained. The talk was about the drought and the depression and the government and local doings. Many families went broke in those times and gave up, auctioning the farm to pay the bills and then leaving town. That is part of the reason Mike and I were not afraid when we first saw the ship and the men. I felt that they would do us no harm and might, in some way, help us out. I don't know why I felt like that, but I was convinced we were safe with them. Although the boys visited the site repeatedly, it was weeks before they had another encounter. One afternoon, Leo recounted, our persistence was rewarded and we again watched the ship come in for a landing. This time, we were about 800 feet from the spaceship when we encountered their invisible wall, the closest we had been to them yet. I still figured there must be some way we could get closer, and somehow get to talk to these men. We waved and hollered, but to no avail. Many return trips proved uneventful, though others brought insights about the strangers. The boys would check the actual landing area for signs of the landed machine, but found no markings of any kind. The earth was completely undisturbed, observed Leo. I thought it was mighty strange that there was no sign of any heavy object having landed there, and that, surely those four mighty prongs beneath the ship would have left some holes in the ground. One afternoon the boys watched a jackrabbit bounce off the invisible force field. The rabbit, then, nuzzled up against the wall with what must have been a sore nose, moved along it one way and the other, and then just hopped off. We got a peaceful feeling from the men. Their movements near the ship were peaceful and purposeful. I got the feeling they probably were making a survey of some kind. We always thought of them as men, people, humans like us. Neither of us could quite accept the fact that these people might be from a very distant planet, yet both of us were able to sit there and think about the possibility. Leo describes the departure of the spaceship. There was no sound, but we could distinctly feel the earth vibrating, he explained. This vibration continued for long moments until we wondered what was going to happen. Then we heard a slight hum, and the vibration ended. It was the first time I ever heard anything like a mechanical sound associated with the ship. The outer shell of the ship started turning, rotating faster and faster with perfect smoothness. Then it suddenly started rising. Those four tremendous prongs, which were maybe 4 feet by 8 feet, began receding into the body of this flying machine. Again the earth started vibrating and we heard this slight hum. It was not loud enough to draw attention for any distance at all. Then the ship started lifting higher, going straight up. A tremendous amount of colored light flashed out from the ship. It kept going straight up. The speed was so great that when it got about 10 or 15 feet off the ground, it completely vanished. It is significant, Barry pointed out to me, that although the ship was literally as big as a barn, it did not exert enough force on the earth to leave footprints. The 4 foot 8 foot prongs would imply 4 contact points with earth, each the size of two coffins side by side. Perhaps the prongs served an electrical grounding function rather than providing mainly structural support. Vibration ended when the prongs left the earth. Leo wished they could have taken photographs, but the cost of a camera, films, and processing was beyond most adults in those difficult times. Leo also expressed doubt that the unusual men would want any photographs taken. Attempts to obtain proof were further stalled when the boys failed to persuade some of their playmates to accompany them on their trips. Another landing occurred toward the end of August 1932. On this occasion the brothers were a little closer than before. As the ship approached the ground, we found ourselves immersed in the invisible field of force. It came over us like a flood of water that got thicker and thicker as the ship dropped lower and lower until we could not move. Always before, we couldn't get any closer. Now we couldn't get out. We were caught inside the shell of force and were unable to free ourselves, no matter how hard we tried. We were just sitting on the ground and watched the door open and the men appear again. The door was so different from any doors we had ever seen, and it opened in such a very unusual way. I have no words to describe it. Anything capable of traveling at such a great speed, I reasoned, would have to be very complex. We thought if we could get close enough to them, we might be able to talk with them. I knew this wouldn't be easy and I was a little scared to try it. But they held us in their forces. We could not get any closer to them, so, we just sat there keeping an eye on that ship. They had come here for some other reason than just advertising. Here we were, trapped maybe 200 or 300 feet from the ship, fighting our feelings of panic. I wish I could adequately convey the way we were rapidly alternating from feelings of fear to safety, from doubt to curiosity, from wonderment to speculation. The great intensity of the experience is very memorable to this day. They gave us the feeling that they were very interested in what was happening with the plants and creatures in the countryside. These impressions were entering our minds just like our own thoughts. 3 days later, on August 28th, at around 8 in the evening, the craft returned to the valley. As we approached the ship, moving carefully down the brushy, uneven hillside, we could see them moving about, strangely illuminated in the growing shadows. We again found ourselves blocked by that invisible force, but we were now far closer than we'd ever been. By this time, we had concluded the barrier was like a magnetic force that affected people and animals instead of iron and steel. 6 men were outside the craft, all about the same build and size. Developed knowledge they could not account for, said Leo. They listened to our excited words, but watching them, I don't think they quite believed us. First contact, early one evening, following numerous unsuccessful trips to the site. The boys had another close encounter with the mysterious men and their flying machine. As we started down the hill, said Leo, we found ourselves in quite a different situation than before. The magnetic force they used to keep us at a distance was behind us and we were free to walk cautiously up toward the landing site. As we approached the ship, these people were outside with smiles on their faces. They were very calm, and just went about their exercises and made us feel welcome, like we weren't in the way. We stopped our approach at maybe 8 or 10 feet from the nearest of them, and just stood there watching. We could hear no sounds in the strange stillness so near the tremendous ship. 4 this close, We were nearly overwhelmed by its huge dimensions. These men were so ordinary looking in one way and so exotic in another. I noticed that they had light brown hair that was cut much the same as Mom cut ours. Their complexion was very light beige, resembling a good tan. Their eyes were blue with a dark pupil. I would guess their weight to be about 140 pounds, since they were a little taller and more heavily built than my father. All of them looked to me to weigh about the same and be about the same size and build. Their hands and feet were shaped like ours, but their shoes were totally unlike our own, without laces or soles. The fabric of their clothing was very unusual, with a subtle pattern visible only when the light was just right. The color and cut of the uniform was the same from a distance, but that subtle pattern was different from one to another of them. Their otherwise identical uniforms looked like they were neatly pressed, but did not have badges or any other insignia that might show rank, like our soldiers did. These men were as alike as peas in a pod. Now that we were up close to it, we found the color of the ship to be a light blue that blended smoothly into the color of the sky. When viewed against the sky, the ship was strangely difficult to detect, either close up or from a distance. There was sort of a haze to it. We just stood there and looked back and forth from the ship to the men. They occasionally looked at us and smiled, then continued with their exercises. I was able to talk German probably better than English at the time, although our tongues were tied and we just couldn't speak. There were three of them, and they stood there and looked at us. They appeared to be very relaxed with that unusual smile on their faces. Their smile was like ours, and, maybe more gentle than any smile I have ever seen. When Mike tried talking, in a mixture of English and German, to the closest man, they all merely continued with their exercises. Two of the men walked back into the ship and another came out, walked over to the boys and said, "In German, I can speak your language," and then, "In English, we speak all languages of all people on your planet." We asked them some questions, not very deep questions, because we felt curiously tongue-tied, explained Leo. We had meant to ask a million questions, but in the end we asked very few. The conversation with him lasted for only a few minutes. Leo now noticed that the men were wearing thin, light-colored gloves. No women were on board. I asked Leo why this was so. "There are women," he responded, "but I never met them." 5. The brothers were hoping to be invited on board. But it was not to be. Finally, one of the men approached the boys and addressed them, in perfect German, "You have had quite an experience with us, and shown great determination in coming to visit us again and again. You have seen much, you have learned much, and you know more about us than most people in your world. No one will believe you when you tell them about us, and," addressing Leo, "not until you are an old man. In your own minds, you will always know the truth about what you have experienced and felt." The man repeated this in English, then continued in German, "We are very real and we are from another galaxy. We have traveled to your planet for over 5,000 years. We are from a place far beyond your world by millions of years in time. We continue traveling to your planet because it is part of our responsibility. We are showing you a small part of what you can expect in the future. You cannot learn everything at one time without rest. You will see us again before long." Leo used the term galaxy very loosely. Barry advised me. I got the impression that, in his mind, the term would apply to the planetary system of another star or perhaps to a different dimension or time as easily as to another star cluster beyond the Milky Way. He often called the visitors time travelers. 6. I did not ask them any more questions and we did not get into the spaceship, Leo continued. When we wanted to know something, it was clear we had to be able to ask the right questions before we could get any answers. He stood before us for a few seconds more with that gentle smile on his face, then turned and joined the others. I was now certain that they were far older than anyone we had ever met before, explained Leo. They had very old, wise eyes and bodies that appeared to be young and fit. I decided that they must have far better methods to protect their health and must live in a much better environment than we do. They glowed with perfect health. I also knew they deeply respected our Earth. This was why they didn't leave rubbish about, why their area was always clean. I was now firmly convinced that these travelers from the spaceship could definitely read our minds. They responded to the questions, thoughts, and desires in our minds, and in turn were able to place their own thoughts, intentions and beliefs in our minds without using words. When viewed close up, the craft appeared to be constructed of one single piece of material without individual component parts. The ramp and supports beneath the ship appeared to join to the main body of the ship with no visible seams. Another encounter occurred in the same valley, late in the day on September 19. Again, the boys were not prevented from approaching the craft. I do not know why, but I had the impression that the force field was still there, but they tuned it somehow to allow us to pass through, Leo asserts. The craft did not reflect light like ordinary objects, rather, it seemed to absorb the light around it and produce its own subtle light of any color or pattern of shades. Sounds did not echo off it like the wall of a barn or the face of a cliff. You could stand right next to it and not even notice it was there. It was more like a living thing that watched and reacted to its surroundings, than a machine or building. Maybe they were putting on a show for us, because the appearance of the ship began doing the most amazing things. One moment it would blend into the sunset, matching every color and pattern. Then it would go like oily water and abruptly change to a polished mirror or a dark, non-reflective surface like a hillside. It took many minutes for us to work our way to the clearing near the ship. At first, the boys did not notice anyone near the ship as they walked up to it, nor the silent lowering of the ramp. But they became aware of a man standing next to one of the huge legs that supported the ship. The man made eye contact with the boys and had started to speak before they suddenly realized there were two men. "The to speak to us," continued, turning to the other as he spoke, in flawless German. "These boys would like to touch our ship. Make sure it is well grounded, for we probably have developed some electrostatic charge in our travels." There was no greeting. I think he simply picked the top item off the jumbled pile of our thoughts and responded to it. Then we were given the opportunity to touch something from another galaxy for the first time. The feeling of touching the ship, which definitely sent a chill up my spine, is also very difficult to explain. I expected it to be hard and metallic, but to this day, I find it hard to believe the feeling I had touching something that was so smooth and exchanged no heat with my hand. It was neither warm nor cold, and was definitely smoother than glass or polished metal, which will stick to your hand. It was like trying to press one magnet against the same pole of another, like I was not really touching anything at all. The colors were somehow projected from inside it, or emanated from it, instead of reflecting as from a painted surface or a mirror. At that particular moment, the colors seemed to match the sky and even the clouds. The ship was made in such a way, or of such a material, that once it rose several hundred feet in the air, it looked just like the sky. We accomplished our next goal in short order when we found ourselves shaking the hand of one of the visitors. It was his actual hand, not through a glove like I had often seen them wear. The hand was everything at one time without rest. "You will see us again before long." Leo used the term galaxy very loosely. Barry advised me. I got the impression that, in his mind, the term would apply to the planetary system of another star or perhaps to a different dimension or time as easily as to another star cluster beyond the Milky Way. He often called the visitors time travelers. I did not ask them any more questions and we did not get into the spaceship, Leo continued. When we wanted to know something, it was clear we had to be able to ask the right questions before we could get any answers. He stood before us for a few seconds more with that gentle smile on his face, then turned and joined the others. I was now certain that they were far older than anyone we had ever met before, explained Leo. They had very old, wise eyes and bodies that appeared to be young and fit. I decided that they must have far better methods to protect their health and must live in a much better environment than we do. They glowed with perfect health. I also knew they deeply respected our Earth. This was why they didn't leave rubbish about, why their area was always clean. I was now firmly convinced that these travelers from the spaceship could definitely read our minds. They responded to the questions, thoughts, and desires in our minds, and in turn were able to place their own thoughts, intentions and beliefs in our minds without using words. When viewed close up, the craft appeared to be constructed of one single piece of material, without individual component parts. The ramp and supports beneath the ship appeared to join to the main body of the ship with no visible seams. Another encounter occurred in the same valley, late in the day on September 19. Again, the boys were not prevented from approaching the craft. I do not know why, but I had the impression that the force field was still there, but they tuned it somehow to allow us to pass through, Leo asserts. The craft did not reflect light like ordinary objects, rather, it seemed to absorb the light around it and produce its own subtle light of any color or pattern of shades. Sounds did not echo off it like the wall of a barn or the face of a cliff. You could stand right next to it and not even notice it was there. It was more like a living thing that watched and reacted to its surroundings, than a machine or building. Maybe they were putting on a show for us, because the appearance of the ship began doing the most amazing things. One moment it would blend into the sunset, matching every color and pattern. Then it would go like oily water and abruptly change to a polished mirror or a dark, non-reflective surface like a hillside. It took many minutes for us to work our way to the clearing near the ship. At first, the boys did not notice anyone near the ship as they walked up to it, nor the silent lowering of the ramp. But they became aware of a man standing next to one of the huge legs that supported the ship. The man made eye contact with the boys and had started to speak before they suddenly realized there were two men. The one who had started to speak to us continued, turning to the other as he spoke, in flawless German. These boys would like to touch our ship. Make sure it is well grounded, for we probably have developed some electrostatic charge in our travels. There was no greeting. I think he simply picked the top item off the jumbled pile of our thoughts and responded to it. Then we were given the opportunity to touch something from another galaxy for the first time. The feeling of touching the ship, which definitely sent a chill up my spine, is also very difficult to explain. I expected it to be hard and metallic, but to this day, I find it hard to believe the feeling I had touching something that was so smooth and exchanged no heat with my hand. It was neither warm nor cold, and was definitely smoother than glass or polished metal, which will stick to your hand. It was like trying to press one magnet against the same pole of another, like I was not really touching anything at all. The colors were somehow projected from inside it, or emanated from it, instead of reflecting as from a painted surface or a mirror. At that particular moment, the colors seemed to match the sky and even the clouds. The ship was made in such a way, or of such a material, that once it rose several hundred feet in the air, it looked just like the sky. We accomplished our next goal in short order when we found ourselves shaking the hand of one of the visitors. It was his actual hand, not through a glove like I had often seen them wear. The hand was and warm, the grip firm. Although I was right in the middle of what was probably the biggest thrill I ever had, I found myself thinking, "Sure would like to get into that ship. I think that can be arranged," came the reply to Leo's unspoken thought. "But first, you will have to go through a process to enter the ship. There is nothing to be afraid of, and you will have to go through the process again to leave the ship." The man explained that this process was controlled by what today might be termed an invisible energy beam or field of radiation, comparing it with the energy field that prevented approaching the ship. "I understood that it was a modified form of the invisible shield," said Leo. "I finally began to recognize that they were giving us information in some way other than by just what they had told us, and that they were communicating with us, not so much by what they were saying and we were hearing, but more by what we were feeling. As Leo explained to me, they can open up areas of the brain that we don't use. And they made it clear that we have 12 senses, not 5.7. They seemed to realize that our world was in trouble, and understood about the depression and the drought as we talked about failed crops and the grasshoppers that were invading our country. They, also, gave us the indication that man would soon bring terrible wars and suffering upon himself. Inside the spaceship finally, the boys were invited aboard the spaceship. The huge ramp descended silently, and, almost before we knew it, We were escorted up the ramp by the man we had been speaking directly with and at last found ourselves entering the ship. There was an inner and an outer door.